The presentation I'm going to be talking to you about is really pretty different than what we've just heard so far. Really talking about a population that I wish there were more of at the APHA, which is our military, active duty and veterans, other than just in the Peace Caucus. I'm an epidemiologist and anthropologist by training and have been involved in active duty military now for about 7 years. Prior to that had been involved with setting up family drug treatment courts, which are a modality where women that were using drugs typically during pregnancy or where the cases were child abuse neglect were diverted from the children not necessarily going to foster care, but where they could work together into a therapeutic court, not unlike the veteran courts. And what we're really talking about here now, I'm working with the National Council of Juvenile Family Court Judges to see if there's a possibility of developing a model where we could move along that parallel lines with our active duty military and our veteran population. So I'm just going to go back. This really is still a question if we really do have clashing cultures, or can we promote partnerships here in really different kind of culture groups. And the problem is that the military still has a notion that the military takes care of its own. The gates are very much closed on both sides. There's a completely separate system of military justice. So a lot of things that happen inside the gates don't ever get out into the civilian side until they're really pretty far down the line, where we have infant deaths, suicide, homicides, the things that you see in the paper these days. So this is really what we want to talk about. I've been working with the National Council, which is NCJSCJ, for 30 years now, really, but just recently on this issue. And I want to just remind us in the first almost dozen slides or so, more than that, of what the context is that we're dealing with. This is a very, very high-risk population of active duty and veterans, and a lot of times folks somehow don't make that connection, that the DOD is on one side, the VA is on the other. There's absolutely no connection between these two systems of care, but the, you know, you're in the military one day and the next day you're a veteran, and so the services somehow don't connect very well, however. So just to remind us of what that context is, I'll summarize some survey findings that we did with some judges, about 400 a year ago, and we've subsequently drilled down further to find more about what the needs are, looking at some of the unique child custody issues, and then some recommendations that we might have for how we can move this further. Because this is actually kind of a black box to a lot of people, I thought I'd just remind you that these are the different branches of service. Big Navy and Marines are actually part of the Navy. These are the different branches, and they all really have different cultures, very, very different. The DOD is a fiction as far as each of these branches are concerned. It doesn't have any budget allocations for one thing, and each one of them have their own separate lines of command, and therefore you have to work with the individual branches, which makes it even more challenging when you're working with them in the civilian systems of care. Just a reminder, too, that even though you know, we sort of realize now, I think, that we only have 1% of our population and are all volunteer military involved in the military. We have, they're in every state. The first five states, California, Virginia, Texas, North Carolina, have almost half the population. However, this is only with your active duty population, and every state has lots and lots of Guard and Reserve, who we have disproportionately relied on during this last decade plus of war now. We have disproportionately deployed these folks to multiple deployments, and in fact a lot of our mortgage crisis and a lot of other things are really behind that issue, which we'll get to, but every single state has them. We just don't necessarily identify them. We don't ask, typically. Well, we've heard the number that 1% of our population is involved in the military, sort of the other 1%, which is about 2.5 million people, for the first time in history, we now actually have more dependents in our military than we have active duty service members. So there are 5.3 million Americans that comprise our armed forces, and this is just talking about the dependents, okay? So this means people on page two, your wife or your kids or your husband. 58% are family members, and 41.9% are service members. This means there's been a huge shift, really, in where their care needs to go. It used to be they said, you know, if the military had wanted you to have a wife, they would have issued you one. Well, now because it's an all, you know, all volunteer military, they can't really tell you that anymore. So there's a lot more that are married. 63% of them live in the community, but they don't necessarily self-identify as active duty. They're a very young population, and they've been deployed a lot, redeployed multiple times. There's a policy in the military that says that you need to have a 2-to-1 deployment. You can be gone for 12 months, and then you must have dwell time back in the States of 24 months. That has not been in effect during this entire last decade plus. It has been in effect in the NATO countries, by the way, which is why they don't have, well, it's one of the major reasons, other reasons as well, but we know that an increased dwell time makes a big difference in terms of reducing hypervigilance and a lot of the other things that are related to PTSD. Some of the other countries that have been involved in these two wars have not had this kind of problem with multiple deployments, and they do better. Again, just to make sure you get a picture of you're all public health folks, so the things we're looking at really are risk factors. We've got a young population, we've got folks that have had a lot of previous existing problems sometimes. We've had an unprecedented use, as I said, of our Guard and Reserve. Many, many more women in the military now. This is in our active duty population. It's now 14% compared to 3% during the Vietnam conflict. And in our Guard and Reserve, it's almost 20%, which is really changing the nature of our military and of our parenting issues that we have when we have high-risk problems and of our domestic violence kind of scenarios. And the average base pay is very low. We're really talking poverty line, $24,000 a year. And again, this is when you have people going from Guard and Reserve status into the military. You really have problems of not being able to pay the mortgage and other problems. So I'm just going to quickly click through here. I think I already mentioned that. This is a real nerd slide that I would give you longer time on if I had it, but you can look at this later on. Part of the reason I put these slides in is if you are interested, you can go find them on the APHA website. But what we're really seeing here is that we've had a real drawdown out of our troops, and that's happening now. We're reducing by 100,000 or so, and it's related to a lot of stress in this population as they are now not being able to find jobs back in the civilian workforce. We have more than 2 million children that have been affected by their parents' wartime deployments. Some kids that are in middle school now have never known their parent at home. So there's a real challenge in terms of coherence and meaning within the context of a family. The data here so shows the increase of child maltreatment. It's a 45% substantiated increase in child maltreatment within the Army and an 85% increase in substantiated domestic violence cases. And when I say substantiated, that's happening inside the gates. That's happening within what they're called their family advocacy programs. That does not necessarily translate into getting into the community and getting into your child protective services or into your home, you know, your domestic violence shelters or whatever. So there's some separation in our data that's out there. Just as a reminder of how much families change, and having worked for a long time in the foster care and child welfare populations over the years, I really found it remarkable how I did not feel ill at ease working with this population. A lot of the reintegration challenges look a lot like our children reunifying from foster care. Depending on the developmental stage, there are real challenges of dealing with the new parent integrating and with the parenting relationships of how are you going to co-parent in these situations, which leads to a lot of conflict, especially when they may have married the week before they went off to deploy in the first place. A lot of triple strollers on a lot of the installations that I'm on, a very young population. Of course, this is what we see in the news all the time, is that a very large percentage of this population does have diagnosed PTSD. A lot of it's not well diagnosed, actually. I think we probably have a lot more that is subclinical. What we've been aware of, and I think it's really important, is that in the last decade or so, we've had a lot of waivers to get into the military, where folks didn't have to have a high school diploma, didn't have to, could have had felonies, could have had misdemeanors, And as those of you that work with PTSD and traumatic brain injury might know, is that the CDC works a lot with that population in our jails and our prisons. So being incarcerated or having jail time, felony misdemeanors, is almost a marker for some of those exposures, and the adverse childhood exposure. It means that we have a lot of folks, I believe, in our military that had waivers, that have that background. So we have sort of a setup, folks that are predisposed to potentially move into a PTSD diagnosis. Traumatic brain injury is a signature injury of this of these conflicts. For those of you who aren't familiar with the catchphrases, it's Operation Enduring Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and Operation New Dawn, which is where we are right now in Iraq. It's not that we're not in Iraq anymore, it's Operation New Dawn, since we've theoretically sort of won there, for what it's worth. We also are not having, the fatality rates are much lower in this population. However, the anxiety and the ongoing problems is amazing. I thought I would include this just as a reference point, because this is something our judges are very concerned about as well, is we have a completely new formulary in theater combat. This is from the Combat Operational Behavioral Health textbook of Military Medicine 2011. These are what are in the field. These are actually at your forward operating bases. So these don't even have to be dispensed with any diagnosis, nor by a clinician. And so these are what we're seeing, and now there's a lot of critiquing, especially on the benzodiazepines, because it's a disinhibitor, and they're really concerned about the problems that it may be contributing to our suicide epidemic. That's just one little piece of, but the other ones here you may as well, you're familiar with some of these perhaps as well, and they're very concerning, because folks are having these when they're in the theater, and then they may not necessarily be continuing with them when they actually return into a veteran status, and there's discontinuity of care, and we have some real problems with managing care after that. We also have many fewer fatalities, but many more injuries that are going to last for a very, very long time with this population. So I'm enlisting you all to join this cause. If you haven't gotten a little pitch here, I think this is a really high-risk population that I hope we can all be more aware of. That's pretty clear. Increased suicides has been in the news daily. What hasn't been mentioned as much is the increase in spouses' suicides and in military-connected children suicides. As we know, it's in the suicide talk, but there's a lot of contagion in suicide, and we are seeing a real increase in spouses and in kids. So why I'm here to really talk about is that the courts have begun to see this population coming into their systems, not just our veteran courts, which has also been on 60 Minutes, et cetera, but our family, juvenile, and dependency courts, which is your child abuse neglect, your divorce cases, your juvenile cases of your adolescents getting in trouble. And they have really been completely unfamiliar with this population, really not knowing what are the laws, what do we need to deal with. So last year, we sent out a survey to just nationwide. This is the methodology. It was a snowball sample. It was just to really get a picture of what was going on, what were people seeing. We had 404 respond to the survey. Ultimately, that was drilled down to about 310. About 40% of them were judges. Others were attorneys. We had good state representation nationally and high percentage of urban areas. What we found is that about half of them had contact at least basically every month or more than that, and some of them had much less than that. Most of them that responded that were qualified to participate in the survey had contact with an active military installation or within their jurisdiction. And we don't know exactly how many this survey was sent out to. As I said, it was a snowball sample and people were encouraged to send it on, so we don't really know what our response rate was here. But we then went back and drilled down with some of these that had more than once a week participation or biweekly participation contact with military, and those were typically in areas where there was an installation, a high concentration of military folks that they were aware of. What we were really looking at was what do they perceive as the biggest need and the concern. So these were open-ended questions, and what we found is that the issues of child custody related to child support calculations. These are right, judges and attorneys. They're wanting some really tight information. And they wanted information about how to manage the visitation. When we had some more qualitative conversations with these folks, they were very worried about allowing unsupervised visitation with children, especially young children, and their service member parent. And it was really based on their exposure to this population vis-a-vis popular media, Time Magazine, and around the notion that this person is going to murder their kids and themselves and were violent and aggressive. They were very concerned about the effects of deployment on the, and they typically use the word soldier, although a Marine would be very upset if you called him a soldier. They use the word soldier and family and around how this affected the mental health of the family. They assumed that the families were going to be damaged, which isn't necessarily the case, although there's a, I mean, basically there's a lot of resiliency in this population. And it isn't necessarily so that they are going to all be at disproportionate risk, but it is important to tease out who is there. And they were also interested in something called the Service Member Civil Relief Act, which is a piece that allows service members to have dispensation in terms of showing up for trial when you or in hearings when they can't be present. These were the top-ranked issues that they were concerned about. And I just thought I would throw this out here. They're very concerned about intimate partner violence and family violence. They're concerned about differential reporting standards. And I will just mention on number four that that there are very, very differential reporting standards between civilian circumstances and military. Incident determination committees are established that have flow charts that decide whether or not there can be a restricted report or an unrestricted report, and whether or not it will get kicked at the chain of command, and whether the person will be court-martialed. And so there's very, very careful distinctions around that, and they're quite careful to not get it outside the gates if they can avoid it. These were the main issues they were worried about, though, and that is what we are now trying to teach, develop some teaching tools towards with this population of judges and their court teams. The next list is a set of things that they were less concerned about. What I found was interesting is that they really weren't interested in number 11, for example, here. They did not see veterans courts as models for themselves. They were not thinking about separate dockets or different ways to handle this population. They kind of just figured they would fold it in. They weren't really as concerned about women in the military, thinking that it was a very small percentage, when in fact it's a really growing population. And while only 9% of our service members that are female are married, have male spouses, they account for about 33% of our divorces. So it's a really disproportionate number of spouses of the service members that are bailing on their wives as they return from the field, whatever. So it's really a big challenge, and I think it's contributing to the homelessness that we're seeing really growing in our female veteran population. So these are just some of the things that we're going to be working on in the next while and that we began drilling down on further. One of the things that's of concern to us a little bit as well is the tools that they wanted to have the information shared with them in, is that webinars they wanted to be one of the main sources. They really weren't interested in curriculums or in publications. Webinars really are very dependent on their presenters and their sort of one-shot bits of information. And what we know about bench cards, and for those of you that aren't familiar with the courts, it's really a checklist. And it has been shown to be quite biased in that it really, just having the reference of something, if you just say, is there PTSD present or not, it immediately sets up a question within that individual's mind as to, you know, depending on how they feel about PTSD or what they know about PTSD, it's a flag. So checklists tend to actually have a lot of bias involved in them. So these are things that we want them to be paying attention to, and I'm not going to actually go into this, but this will be on your, if you're interested, you can look at it further. These are some of the things that we're working with them on around how to figure out some of these issues. One of the things that we're really concerned about is the visitation centers and visitation programs, is that when you have supervised visitation, typically the person with the supervised visit has to pay for that supervision, which can run between $75 and $100 an hour. And what ends up happening is that these service members, whether it be a female or a male, on a very low income, can't do that, and they end up failing to have a visitation with their children, and they then, access to their kids is then removed because they're not availing themselves of that opportunity that was in their court order, and they're losing custody. That then leads very frequently to conflicts and issues with trying to, kidnapping and other kinds of things that are sort of on the extreme end, but real problems in terms of allowing this set of families to try to heal and regain reintegration in a family unit. So these are our challenges. We believe, and that we're working on now, over the last year, we've done a lot of work with our judges, recognizing that awareness, just even identifying the population, understanding the differences within the military, willingness to learn the resources and go out of their way. One of the big problems with our commands is that they change every 2 years. So your leadership on the military installations or other places will be rotating a lot, and it's very difficult for the judges and other groups to maintain kind of continuity. And then authority to act. We have to work within a lot of different federal and state legislations in order to even access the installations. These are our recommendations. One of the things I'm really excited about is that on number 8, we are working to expand the model from the veteran court model to do what we did with family drug treatment courts, is to really establish a court which will allow the entire family to come in, recognizing a real therapeutic approach to the challenges that they're having with child abuse and neglect or with domestic violence or substance abuse, different kinds of issues, and working on that right now. So we're working on a lot of the other sort of things at a federal level as well in terms of interstate compact. Our children in the military are staying in out-of-home placement a lot longer because there's no kinship care near where the family is stationed, and so they have a real problem in terms of being able to comply with federal legislation. So it's a population that I am hoping more of you will engage with, because there's plenty of work in this group. So thank you for your interest.
So this time we're going to just ask the presenters to come up and take up questions. You can direct them to either the presenters or the panel as a whole, and so anybody can have a question.
This is for Kathleen. Most of the recommendations that you came up with were enforcement related, and as an environmental intervention strategy is probably the least common use in community efforts to change violence, domestic violence, family violence, at least what I'm learning in my state of Alaska. Do you find that those approaches are more effective than community-based or education or social normative approaches?
I think what we were looking at was within the context of the court system and what they can do.
Oh, so they were just related to the nature of the study.
That's right. Okay. That's right. I think it is. But interestingly, I do think that that is effective in this context. And there's really there's a lot to be said for hierarchy in the military and for following orders, honestly. And there's a lot of sticks in the system, right? I mean, and fewer than carrots, honestly. So that it's yet to be seen, but there. We are looking at that, and it really was because of the nature of the population that I'm really working with them within the court context. What are the tools we have to work with? But just want to add is that the judges are also a great group to work with, because they can very quickly get to their service providers. They can convene their teams in the community, and that then would sort of go out to say, I want to make sure that you have a program in place that is therapeutic. So they would be using their enforcement regulations to empower the community to provide services that are targeted to the population, which might be therapeutic, might be educational, might not be so enforcement driven.
Thank you.
So thank you for that clarification, Ashley.
I see a hand being back, but because of the moderator, I get to ask a question before you. Related to that, I had a question around when you were presenting the slides, you talked about how the judges have been important. They were kind of thinking about was family court judges, but you said, I mean, family courts that kind of are based on a drug court model, but that's one of your recommendations. Can you talk about the disconnect there?
That the judges hadn't thought.
Yeah.
They hadn't. They're a conservative group, and it, you know, it took us a while to get the family drug court treatment model out there, and I think that they are just on the cusp. I mean, we now have a few judges that are real leaders in this field that are moving in that direction. I think the reason why we're making that recommendation, even though it wasn't their first response to kind of get into it, is because it's so effective. And that we really feel that a family-centered approach is really what's needed with this population. It's definitely intergenerational. I failed to mention that almost 50% of our military now come from a military family. So we have a really caste system here, actually. there's a real need for that kind of an intervention. And we have now, actually, in the last year since this was study was done, we found about a dozen judges now that are open to this idea.
Okay.
So we think that we can move it forward, but it wasn't the first place that they went
when
we began talking about it. Yeah.
So for Mary, I have a very soft voice. I hope I would. You talked about the women in the categories.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about the interviewing that you did with them. But I didn't know what was it in their background and men. Were they also victims of battery? The women that were married? I didn't hear you talk about their history of abuse.
Some of them were, not all of them, but there was a high amount of them that had physical abuse past.
So they were
arrested.
They became abusers.
Yeah.
So they were bad women, and then they became bad workers of the same person.
We don't really know the order to which, whether or not
so
they were charged.
We don't know if the bad incident occurred in early life, and then later life they became bad.
We did have a childhood survey that wasn't part of this presentation to see like if what abuse they had back when they were growing up, but it's hard to tell really for current abuse whether or not after the charges happened if they were battered or what order that went in.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that you weren't controlling for kind of temporal effects, kind of looking at when the abuse occurred, who was the primary aggressor, and then what that meant for intervention. Kind of get at what you're asking right there. Okay. Yeah, there's a whole dynamic that's attached to that. I had a question related to that because on the flip side, in the batterer, so this was a question that kind of was like nagging me in my head. In the batter intervention groups with men who are perpetrators of violence, one of the refrains that they oftentimes have is that their partners are crazy. And so the question that comes up for me was, how might your research help to perpetuate that myth or that stereotype that the women that they're attached to kind of have these psychological problems, which is why the abuse is occurring, not that they're accountable and they're using their violence to control the situation. So it was just a question that was kind of nagging in my head there.
I think it also is a little different because these are people that have been charged with domestic violence, opposed to like just victims that haven't had any charges.
Well, the issue oftentimes happened and kind of so the pushback. Something I just want you to think about as you move your research forward. The pushback that often happens in most states, Connecticut, where I live, for example, there's a mandatory arrest state. And so even in the event where he might be the primary aggressor, if he can also demonstrate that he was physically attacked, she too would be arrested as a function of the police officers not wanting to have
to decide who was the primary aggressor. And so we see a number of dual arrests, which doesn't necessarily mean that she was the primary aggressor within that context. So the issue that comes up for me is being arrested does not necessarily signify that one is singularly a perpetrator. It can also mean that one is a victim too. And so kind of being mindful of that. Good.
But there's a lot of research being done on those questions themselves to look at
what do women think? What do they mean when they say that? You know, are they saying, yeah, I think I should be beaten? And it's like, no, in these focus groups, one of the things that they're learning is that women are acknowledging that I live in a society where if this happens, this is what I think will happen to me, but I don't think it's okay. And it was, there's a really interesting paper by, I could give you a reference, by someone who, they have these accounts that the women gave of what should happen to their husband for abusing them, and they're like, we think he should be castrated, and da 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 da, and it's like, it's not okay, and yet it's happening. And so I think there's a lot of, I mean, that's just one focus group, and there's different perspectives around that. But the whole sort of social norm, a lot of my other research does look at, in communities that have higher normative tolerance, what happens. And one of the things I find is that women's status is extremely dangerous in those places. Having higher women's status puts you at risk of abuse. And also, even having more women's groups in a town can have higher abuse if it's a high tolerance city versus if it's a low tolerance city, it can be less abuse. So I'm doing a lot of research on those kind of questions. Thank you.
This is my second. Go ahead, Naomi. On your project, you talked about you're focusing on normative behavior and the changes in that. And although I didn't quite get the whole thing, at the end you were talking about the diffusion and how far do you think that's going to go, and will it extinguish, or is this just, you know, the latest fad or rush? I'm particularly interested in this in light of the first presentation, where you're essentially starting a normative transition a generation ahead. So where people begin to learn different modes of behavior, that's what they're going to teach the kids, and which one may have greater staying power or diffusion power, which of those two approaches?
Oh, comparing the approach of...
The approach of using the coaches to teach the kids, because they're in a teachable moment and a sense of respect. And so they'll teach, if they learn that behavior, that becomes the new norm, and they teach their kids, versus teaching men in a situation where they have to change normative behavior that's been supported for eons.
Well, a couple comments, and I'll give you the floor, too. I think that this kind of thing is going to take us forever. We're talking about human rights and inequality. And so how do you get rid of the patriarchy everywhere? And so I think that one of the things that's positive about Maskwa is that it's a male-initiated movement. It's not coming from, it's no one from the outside saying, you know what you guys need is an intervention program. I mean, and I believe in that's not to say anything about intervention programs. But they're designing this and doing it themselves, and they're working with youth as well. I mean, they go to schools, and they're also working with women. There's women members of Maskwa. So there's no limit to what kinds of activities they do. They do all kinds of things. But I feel like when you're looking at societal norm changes around things like racism, I think the big three, racism, classism, and gender discrimination, you know, we really are looking at like the drops of water on granite, you know, breaking down the rock. It's a big problem. Changes slow.
Well, and I think one of the things that public health does is we do the spectrum of primary prevention to tertiary, right? So there is a gamut. I mean, our program is one piece, and we actually, Brian can speak on this a little more, we also did a program for coaching women in India. So one of the things that we realized that there's a total different cultural societal aspect of the fact that, you know, here there's a norm of that's not okay, as opposed to when we're looking at, you know, a cricket program is where we did this. Like, is there a different type of intervention? We ended up needing to do more social awareness of the topic itself instead of just doing the program. So there is a big societal issue with the fact of just where your environment is. And as far as our study goes with gender equity, we didn't see a difference. And this were high school boys. So now we're actually looking to do middle school because, okay, great, we were able to change behavior. But for whatever reason, the gender equitable attitudes didn't change. So the behavior was able to change. So now that was with high schoolers. So now we're looking, okay, well, middle school now is our target, because are we going to see those attitudes change? Are those attitudes developing, obviously, at a younger age before they get into high school? One of the key things we found from our study is that perpetration was already happening with our ninth graders. So they're already doing this behavior. They already know what they're thinking. So do we need to go with the sixth through eighth to do more primary prevention? You know, we thought we were doing primary prevention, it turned out to be a little more secondary because the behavior changed. But cognitively, we're talking about their attitudes and their behaviors were not lining up. So I think there's a gamut. There's a puzzle to everything, and I think it's just one piece.
Actually, as you talked about that, it raised a question for me related to a couple of things. One is kind of adolescent brain development, kind of thinking about whether or not these young people have the capacity to actually make change in the ways that their cognitions and thoughts. And I have some folks, the behaviorists, will say, we don't really care whether or not their thinking changed, because if we can change the behavior, the thinking will follow. It's a lagging indicator if you've been watching politics, and I seem to be a step obsessed with it. So it raised that question for me, kind of coming back to the issue that you raised. The question for me is it fair for us to be thinking about which is the most effective, or should we be coming at these issues from a number of different places to kind of get to the end point? I would argue that the men in India are also raising young children, and so they're changing the expectations for their sons and daughters and their behaviors around that. That's a generational shift also. And then it is also built on that whole idea that, you know, battery prevention programs traditionally have kind of come from the perspective that men can change, and so regardless of whether or not they were socialized or they have been socialized in a specific way of kind of living, being, and behaving, they can change that, and we have a role to play supporting them in doing that. So, you know, I don't think the dichotomy between a prevention that targeted at adult men or young teenage boys is necessary. It's more so like, let's come at it from whatever tools we have and then kind of try to create a societal shift in general around the way in which we kind of come at
it. Okay, I just want to add one other point to that, which is part of the MassThought goal wasn't to just have men not be violent themselves, but to change society. So I don't know if you noticed, there's like a piece of paper with Hindi writing and it said, let's not tolerate violence on one of my slides. And that's actually these little sheets that one of the MassThought members uses in he teaches at a boys' school. So he has the boys filling out these promise forms that they make these swears that they will no longer do Eve teasing, which is sexual harassment. So he, as a MassThought activist, is doing that training beyond, and it's like they say first do, then say. So, you know, you stop it in your own life, but you also move out into society to do that.
One last question.
What we found in approaching boys and men as well is that talking to boys is a less intimidating proposition to weigh in for many men. So to then eventually what we found is that men are talking to other men through the avenue of, oh, I'm talking to my boy, I'm talking to my
nephew, my son. So you actually get that matter. Fantastic. So I want to thank you guys for sharing your time with us. Please join me. Thank you.